We will call this meeting of the Education Finance Committee to order. First of all, Representative Quam moves approval of the January 20th minutes. Any discussion, corrections, or additions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Today, we are taking testimony on legislative priorities. We have the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation as well as the Minnesota School Boards Association. So at this time, I will call forward the Minnesota School Boards Association, who does not appear to be here. Or are they here and I don't see them?
Mr. Chair, while they're, are you looking for them?
Yes, Representative Grauling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hopefully when we're actually voting on bills, we'll have a quorum.
Well, Representative Grauling, you can always call for a, you can always make a motion to call for a quorum if you'd like, but I would think that the minutes are a little bit different than other activity, but you can certainly call for a quorum if you'd like before those votes are taken.
Mr. Chair, that was my point.
Okay, thank you. Exactly. Point well taken. So, with that, I do not see the Minnesota School Board Association here, so maybe we can just have a polite... Oh, you know what? I have an announcement I should let everyone know about, or maybe I should wait till everybody's here, is that Representative Peterson's not going to be around for a while.
Thursday, because
yep, is he and his wife had a baby this weekend, Paisley Jane Peterson, and mommy and baby are both doing well, and Representative Peterson is doing exactly what he should be doing right now, and that is whatever his wife tells him. So congratulations to the Peterson family. Anyone else have anything for the good of the order while we're waiting for our testifiers? Representative Grauling.
Under the good of the order, I don't know if you're on the Rules Committee or not. Are you?
I am not.
Okay. Do you know yet, Mr. Chair, how the Rules Committee consideration of what can be offered when will play out in this committee?
Representative Grauling, in terms of committee jurisdiction, or what is it? I don't understand what you're saying.
Mr. Chair, I haven't yet looked at the rule, but I've just heard that the Rules Committee is considering or has considered ratcheting down the ability of individual members to offer amendments later on the floor, of that you have to do work in the committee if you're going to be spending money. I'm not sure of the details, and that's why I was wondering if you were.
Well, what I know about it is what we've had in the past, and that is that we have a budget resolution, and then each committee has its own specific target. Yeah. And so, for example, if I wanted to offer an amendment to take dollars from another account and transfer it to education finance, I would not be allowed to do that. I don't know this, Representative Grauling, and I should, but I don't know if there's been any change in that or not. But I know that that's been, since I've been here, that's been the practice, is that each the finance areas have their own individual targets. There's an overall budget resolution, and then within the finance accounts, each one has their own target, so you're not allowed to take from one committee and move it over to another side. But that's always been that way. I'm not aware of any changes. Representative Grauling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that's not what I was, maybe when we learn more about this rule, I would like to discuss that in this committee so that we're absolutely certain what it means. But it's more repressive than that, the way I understand it. That's why I say I'm asking you, because I am not up to speed on it like I would like to be. But the way that I've heard it is that you couldn't even transfer within the committee. Maybe Mr. Crow was at the Rules Committee, or Mr. Strom?
Mr. Crow, Mr. Strom, I think didn't the Rules Committee take this up yesterday? So this information should be public and be available to everyone. Mr. Crow, Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair and Representative Grauling, I was just trying to pull it up on my screen here, and my computer's not coming up, but there's an amendment to, I think, 4.3 that you're referencing, and what that rule does is it limits... basically, it says it puts tighter resolutions tighter limits than the budget resolution does, because in the past you were limited in your expenditures by your target and your by your target. But what did happen was amendments would internally balance by either taking money from different funds, which counts as spending in that other fund but doesn't count as general fund, so it doesn't count against the budget resolution or the target, or in some cases would have a fee or something along those lines. The new rule says that an amendment to a bill that receives a second reading is being considered by the House is out of order if that amendment would increase the spending or spending base, which means the tails, or set the tails at a by referencing spending base, so that would increase the spending or spending base from any fund from which appropriations are made in that bill, or would increase the spending or spending base in total from all funds in the bill or in the bill with the proposed amendment. And so, and then there's an exception for after the last Thursday of session in which the legislature can meet. So it hasn't been put into practice yet, but in practice it would appear to significantly restrict the type of amendments that could be offered relative to the kinds of amendments that would have been in order in the past.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Crow. Could you give one concrete example of an amendment that we've offered in the last year or two that we now could not offer? I'm just trying to understand this.
Mr. Crow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greiling, we don't get them a lot in K-12, and so that, I guess, like in transportation, something that would have spent money out of the trunk highway fund instead of a general fund would have been in order because it would have met the general fund budget resolution limit for that committee, but in adopting this rule, it wouldn't be in order because it spends additional money out of the trunk highway fund, for example.
So, Mr. Crow, and obviously Representative Greiling, I'm going off of what Mr. Crow said here, but like, for example, in the tax committee where you have a negative target, if you were to come forward being the honest progressive you are and you were to offer a income tax increase, and as you've done in the past, would I hear that right, that would be not in order because you would be adding additional...
Yes, that is a great example. It is that would be out of order because it would increase spending in the fund, regardless of whether it's balanced in relation to the target or the budget resolution.
So, Mr. Again, we're in hypotheticals here. We all have the option of modifying these things later. But if it was just a straight tax increase, though, you'd have it would be a larger negative number. It would go down. That would still be allowed, wouldn't it?
I'm sorry. I thought you meant the amendments where the tax increase was used to fund something else, spending. But if it was just a
straight tax increase, the reason why I'm asking is that if you can't move just money between funds,
it would be in order because there wouldn't be any spending. If there was no spending that was tied to that.
So. And Representative Growling, I just want to just take a second just to kind of walk newer members through the budget resolution process, because I'm not really sure if people are up to speed on what that means. And this is something that I think was started in 1999. I think it's when it started, is that you have a budget resolution that says the House of Representatives will spend no more than this amount of money. And whatever this is, you then divvy that out to individual committees, and that is the committee target that people are referring to. So this committee will be given a target by the Ways and Means Committee that says what we're allowed to spend. And so that's what this process is. What we're discussing about now is that in the past you could not take money from DNR or State Gov Finance. You couldn't offer an amendment to take from one account and give it to another. But this language that I'm hearing here is with regards to funds. The question is, what does that mean? And maybe that's what we should, myself and staff should look into this and provide the committee a more updated report on what that means tomorrow.
Mr. Crow, I would just clarify too that it's not just outside of the funds. It is that issue of revenue increases that you just brought up. In the past, spending as it related to the budget resolution or no increase in spending was defined as spending less new revenue. So if an amendment had $100 million of new revenue, for example, from an income tax increase, and then spent $100 million in spent that money and dedicated it to education, it would be out of order because it increases spending, even though relative to the budget resolution and the old definition of spending, it would have been budget neutral or zero.
I believe the term they used was it was spending minus non-tax revenue. So, for example, if you had a fee increase, that would be allowed within your committee's target. At least that's how I remember it when we were in the majority. So, Representative Dabney.
To this point, Mr. Crow, what about tax expenditures? If I offered an amendment, say, to increase exemptions in the sales tax, make some activity sales tax exempt that currently pays sales tax, and increase the tax expenditures of the state, would that be in order?
Mr. Crow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, I'm
I
not
apologize.
Sure. I can say what it looks like to me, that if it's a tax exemption, you're not collecting the money and then paying it back out, so it doesn't look like spending, mm-hmm. and so it wouldn't. But I don't know that that's how the rule would be applied, and that's up to you all. And you know, so.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question. I know you want to get on with the agenda. MSBA may be here by now. I don't see them. Oh, maybe they are. Okay. But I would ask that when we have clarity on this rule, if assuming it comes to pass, and sounds like it will, that we have more detailed information about if are there any examples after our fiscal staff has had a chance to think about it where it would change anything potentially in this committee. But I think if it's going to affect education funding and the ability to have flexibility on behalf of our students in other committees, that every one of us who wants education to be prioritized, we all say that, we had better be crystal clear as to what this rule change means for students. We all know that we haven't been having a very fine track record with education finance in our state for quite a while. And if this rule now means that we can't have flexibility to advocate for students, what if there could be things, some way to be creative and do better by students or get started with the new Minnesota Miracle or any number of things, and then we've hamstrung ourselves just because of some repressive rules that don't allow us to do that. I think we all should be educated on that so we know what we're doing or not able to do that we have been able to do in the past.
Representative Greiling, I will. I and staff will make sure that we look into this, and I would prefer it'll be my goal to have an answer for the committee so we, number one, can understand what this means on the House floor, but also what it means for the committee process.
Thank you very much.
And Mr. Chair.
Mr. Crow.
Just quick, that Mr. Chair and Representative Greiling, this would be a change to the House permanent House rules, which we passed out of the Rules Committee and will be taken up on the floor, so you can have this discussion about this particular change when the rules come before the legislature as well.
Thank you very much.
Okay. So without any other comments, the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation is here. And Lori Davis. Oh, and Mr. Benson, too. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record so 100 years from now we know who you are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. 11 months from now, you won't know who we are. I'm Dwayne Benson with the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation.
And I'm Lori Davis. I'm the Policy Director at the Early Learning Foundation.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
What we'd like to be able to do is kind of walk you through a brief history of the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, some of the things that we found out and a result of that, of what we're going to recommend to this legislative session. As you can see, or not see, this doesn't work well. Okay. The mission of the Early Learning Foundation, we were formed late in 2005. Is to find the most cost-effective strategies to prepare children to succeed in school, particularly preschoolers. We're driven by this notion that half of the children in the state are not prepared for kindergarten. And many of you have heard that. And we also know as learners, we tend to peak very early in life, age 3 actually. In most brain formation, 90% occurs before the age of 6. So I want to walk you through our partnership of foundation, corporate, and civic leaders. Keep in mind that we were originally a creation of the legislature. We were created with envisioning a public-private partnership. The governor was to appoint a certain number of elected officials, providers, and then we were supposed to self-appoint our own board. We did that far in advance. Our first meeting, there was a conscious decision to give back the $1 million that the legislature gave us and to take the operation private. And the thought at that time was that we wanted to be the honest broker. While I was in charge of raising the money, it wasn't welcome news, but in retrospect, it was a very good decision. So we've had that opportunity, as Mike Cerisi says, to be the honest brokers. Let me give you a bit of an overview of what we've attempted to do here. First of all, we're going to make recommendations around the current system without adding money to the system. Secondly, we're going to use market-based solutions. Now, these are not solutions that we think will work. These are solutions that we raised and spent the $20 million and leveraged another $10 million to find out if they actually do work.
Ms. Davis, if you just double-click the slide, doesn't it bring it up automatically?
It's showing something different on my screen than it is on yours because this is a Macintosh. My apologies for this.
Okay, that's right.
I have a flash drive. They're looking for a PC.
Okay, you want to walk up there? I think it's helpful if people see the presentation.
Yeah.
We can just take an extra minute to make sure
we. Sorry about this.
No worries. Yeah, you are the first person to come to this committee and have problems with the technology.
Wayne, can you tell a joke?
So then, when you hit start,
like
start.
Here.
Yeah.
Do our committee assistants have any input in the process, or?
Or
is it not helpful because she's using a Mac? blame Apple.
Because it shows up on her screen.
Ever since Jobs took that medical leave.
Yeah.
They're waiting for that.
Good old Windows. Oh, yeah. Members, next meeting we'll be taking up an amendment to the committee rules prohibiting Macintoshes from being used in committee. For those of you from Apple from listening, we're just kidding. Well, now Windows is going to kick into hibernation mode. Great. Should have kept the puppies around today. Oh, we're looking. This is good. This is a good sign.
Oh, yes. Well, we know where that went.
Yeah, you got to come up here.
I said that, you know, way back when I said if we can't go, can't keep going now, because we're going to go broke. Well, now we're going broke. So, it's full of
Now, since we have some downtime here, members, I'll just make an announcement. I've talked to a couple members about this, but next Wednesday is going to be School Spirit Day in this committee. So members of the committee as well as staff, and for those of you that come to regular hearings, the expectation is you'll be showing up with some sort of school pride by wearing either your favorite school's T-shirt, jersey, sweatshirt, something like that, denoting where you're from. And so that'll be next Wednesday. It'll be School Spirit Day in the committee. And where I do want to say, Representative Bills, I do not want you wearing your wrestling one-piece thing that you wear when you're... What's it called? What is Representative Bills, what is it called?
Mr. Chair.
Yes. No, don't do that. That's Representative Fabian, you have something to add to this wonderful dialogue?
I'd like to amend that rule. I would like to see that.
Yeah. I'll speak for yourself, Representative Fabian. So that'll be next Wednesday. We'll try to send out an email reminder to people and just have it be School Spirit Day. And hopefully there's not a floor session that day, so we're not walking around with our jerseys and sweatshirts on. We're almost there, folks. I can feel it.
Mr. Chair, I'm glad you have a tech expert in here. CLS.
Yes. Representative Myra.
It's Tuesday. Mr. Chair and Mr. Benson, you've said on here that 50% of our children are not ready to go to kindergarten. Could you give us a little bit of history? 10 years ago, was it also 50% of them were not ready to go? 20 years ago, 50%? Oh, it sounds horrible, but how does that compare to the past?
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative
Myra.
We don't have information that goes back a long period of time. Certainly, I'm not aware of anything that goes back over 10 years. I think that number has remained largely unchanged over the recent history, and I don't know how to describe recent history, but it has not changed. Keep in mind that we normally look at this and say, and we'll explain this later on, it's kind of fun to fill these voids, by the way. Keep in mind that 16 to 17% of our children are in poverty. So we can't solely tie it to that, because 50% obviously is a bigger number. So we think, and we're going to explain why information is key for that other certain percent that are not being prepared. Because people don't have information as they make good choices, as they do in other walks of life.
So the intent, again, is to do a better job with the money we have and raise that number considerably. We have some information from various studies that says you close that education gap by nearly 60% by continuing to improve and have more and more children ready over a period of time. That number begins to become much greater in that 80% range.
So what we're going to do here is, members, you have a paper copy of the presentation in your folders. We'll begin with that, but we'll have one question from Representative Dabney here, and then we want to make sure we give you guys a full 30 minutes to get your presentation done to make sure we cover that. So Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, to Representative Myra's question. While Mr. Benson reported a low level of poverty across the state, 16-17%, and a kind of consistency at that 50% level, in Minneapolis we're actually seeing a reduction in the number of kindergartners not ready for kindergarten due to the efforts of the Minneapolis schools in terms of screening, four-year-old programs, coordinating with child care providers, providing curriculum and assistance to them. Even though Minneapolis has about 70% poverty, 71% I think it is, in our schools. So the targeted efforts in my school district have increased the percentage of kids who are ready for kindergarten and allowed the district now to set a goal of all kindergartners reading by, I think it's something ugly like winter break? Third grade, but with aggressive early literacy standards as beginning as early as kindergarten. And seen some success.
So, okay.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Loon, is it quick? Because we want to make sure we get the testimony here.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Really quick. And along these lines, when the statistic is not ready for kindergarten, is that based only on pre-literacy skills, or are there other things that fall into that category as well?
Ms. Davis, Mr. Benson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, it is based on the Minnesota Department of Education School Readiness Survey, which is a sample of kids across the state, which was recently validated by the Human Capital Research Collaborative, Arthur Reynolds, to correlate with third grade reading. So they went back, they used the data from the assessment and looked at if it was predictive of third grade reading, and it was. I'm trying to recall if that instrument looks across domains. Our definition of school readiness that we've used in our pilots looks at pre-literacy, pre-numeracy, social-emotional development, so it looks at a more comprehensive definition. And I am not confident, but I think that the Department of Education could answer that, but I think that they do too, and they define that in their own work that way. So.
All right, so go ahead. Members will save questions until the end of the presentation here, and please we'll just follow along on the slides. If you just let us know when you switch slides.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm on the second slide, the overview of MELF, and as I said earlier,
the one with the little. Sorry.
Thank you. As I said earlier, we were formed public. We take public private. We've taken it private. Many of you have heard Art Rolnick do his presentation of a 16-to-1 return on investment. Art Rolnick gets that 16-to-1 investment by focusing and targeting in on what we call the high return or high reward children. And historically, they were always called high risk. But the high return, that's how you do it. You focus in on this. So that's what this is about. It's a market-based solution. And our return on investment that Art Rolnick talks about is really based on good information. Most of you remember from college when you had a definition of a market. It's ample producers interacting with knowledgeable consumers. We do that, knowledgeable consumers, with Parent Aware that Laurie will explain. That's available, by the way, Parent Aware, for all parents, regardless of socioeconomic background. We raised and spent, as I said earlier, $20 million in private money, and we basically did high rigor. We did pilots, and everything that we recommend is based on the evidence that we found in those pilots. We, as I said earlier, we think this can be done. It should be cost neutral. You should fix the system. We certainly wouldn't advocate for any reductions. And once you fix the system, you may find with the returns on investment that more resources are needed. Original budget was $30 million. We, like everybody else, hit the economic downturn, revised ours to 20, and did some braiding in some of our pilots, so we leveraged some state monies. But all of our funding was private. All of it was raised, almost all of it, 86% by our own board and associated foundation. 100% of it was local, none of it was outside of the state, and through the networks of our board. I should say, if we can turn this to the next page, this is just a sampling of who is on our board. Brad Anderson is the current chairman, recently retired from Best Buy, and you can see the group there of both current active CEOs as well as recently retired. We also have a presence from McKnight Foundation and other groups that have been helpful in this. These people, I have been amazed by. We have never failed to have a quorum. We usually have only one or two absent. We study issues like brain synapses development, and these people are very much engaged in this. The reason they're engaged in this is they get it from the economic perspective, that if these kids aren't ready, it's much harder to educate them. So our focus is in on getting more of the kids that aren't ready ready, so that you can get to the Art Rolnick return on investment. I want to again emphasize this notion that, and depending upon how you measure it, obviously it's a sample, it's inaccurate, but generally speaking, we use that number that half of the kids aren't ready. And 90% of the brain development occurs before the age of five, and as I said, Art Rolnick says you get this return on investment with the high return children and the quality programs. Many of you can recall 2001 when the legislative auditor and at the same time the McKinsey report said basically the same thing. You're spending $400 million roughly and you don't know what you're getting. So let me give you a sense of the size of the industry we're talking about. It's $1.7 billion. Of that, $400 million is spent by some government entity in a combination of state, federal, and to a lesser degree, local. The legislative auditor and others said that the impact of those programs is fairly unclear. So what we're trying to do is bring the value that we all suspect can be there and is currently not being met and do it in a more efficient way. It's very complicated. It's inefficient. We have found out that it doesn't work very well for the people we intend to serve. When we deliver another program beside that that we designed, it works very well. Parents of all socioeconomic backgrounds tend to react the same if it's delivered much better and much different. So we think that a lot of the solutions over the years, well-intended to some extent, have made the problem worse. So we think that what we're trying to present here is an opportunity to fix the current system, do a much better job, get that return on investment, so that in the event future legislatures can look at this and say, we got a return on investment on this, we want to do more of it or less of it. So with that, I'll turn it to Lori Davis, who will talk a little bit about our policy recommendations.
Thank you, Duane. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Our recommendations are based on, as Duane said, we spent the last roughly 5 years, $20 million in private money, running several pilots around in our pilot areas, which include the city of Minneapolis, the city of St. Paul, the Wayzata School District in Blue Earth and Nicollet counties. And we have, along with all those projects, done rigorous evaluation to look at how the programs work for parents and at children's outcomes. And so out of that work, we're now coming to you this session before we sunset with a series of recommendations. The first, I think Duane alluded to, is building more accountability into the system. So for the last, since 2007, we've been piloting the Parent Aware Quality Rating and Improvement System. It's a voluntary, evidence-based system that rates, again, programs who volunteer to be rated, rates them on a 1-4-star scale based on their based on standards that are linked to evidence about which factors of programs promote school readiness for kids. We've been piloting that, as I said, since 2007. We are in the last year of the pilot. This is our board's highest priority, this statewide rollout of Parent Aware. And we would recommend that it be done in a way that's cost-effective. Throughout the pilot, we've tried to look at making this set of quality indicators as efficient and sort of the least burdensome on providers while really moving toward quality improvement. And so that's part of our recommendations. The idea and the way that Parent Aware is different than other states' quality rating systems is that you want this information to be available to parents across the income spectrum. So every parent who's looking at early childhood experiences for their children will be able to look at these ratings. And the idea is that back to the, our Rolnick philosophy, that kind of demand pressure will drive quality throughout the system. So when parents are looking at for quality before Parent Aware, there weren't very many indicators. Accreditation was one way, that, and but very few programs, in terms of all programs in the state, are accredited. So this is a way to do that that's more efficient. And we're really focused on school readiness outcomes through that rating system. We believe that you can roll the system out statewide using current quality child care development fund dollars, and we can talk about the details of the proposal later. There's no bill before the committee now, but generally we believe that you can do this in a way that's cost neutral and has great benefits to programs throughout the state. And this proposal has a very strong coalition of supporters behind it, including the Minnesota's Future Group, which is I think over 60 or maybe more advocacy organizations focused on early childhood, from them to the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and the Business Partnership. Yesterday we heard that the new MinCAN organization has this as one of their three policy priorities, so great support for this effort. The second piece of our proposal is to try to, the second part of the equation, so for the market to work, you've got to have information, but then poor families particularly, we call them high return families, they have to have the resources to be able to access quality programs. They can have all the information in the world, but if they don't have the money to access those programs, it's not going to improve their kids' school readiness. So we would propose that in our pilot, it was the St. Paul Early Childhood Scholarship Program, and we would propose that there be a scholarship program for kids around the state, modeled after what's happened in St. Paul and also the pre-kindergarten allowances, which the legislature passed several years ago, and was they were not part of our pilot, but we did evaluate them. And then our third recommendation is to address issues of the workforce in this industry. So one of the things that we know is that it matters when people who work with kids have training in child development that relates to, you know, their ability to get these kids ready for school. The second thing we know is if they're not paid enough and they leave, it's really bad for kids. So stability and training in the workforce. So we would propose a train and retain tax credit that would allow people who work in rated programs based on their own level of education related to child development and who stay there for a year to access a refundable tax credit that would increase their income and hopefully promote their stability in the field. And then finally, one of the things that MELF has brought to the field and we'd like to try to create mechanisms to maintain is this idea of private investment. So we spent $20 million in private money already. We'd really like to create mechanisms so that that can be replicated throughout the state. So we propose a HERO tax credit that would, for individuals or organizations that give contributions to either improve quality for rated programs or to provide access for those high-return kids to attend high-quality programs, that there would be a tax credit that would be available to them. And then the last piece of the private investment is that our board, the Parent Aware pilot was $4 million. Much of that money came from Ignite, but it was through our broad base of funding that that was supported. And our board has a very strong interest in protecting that investment in the long term. So anticipating and hoping that there will be action to roll out Parent Aware statewide during this session, our board has committed to forming a new private entity that would raise private money to evaluate and market the Parent Aware system as it rolls out statewide. So they're committed to bringing that private money to the table, and in the hopes that the state money would be there to do the quality improvement and to operate the system. So those are our proposals in a nutshell.
I don't know if this next slide shows up. This is, for some of you that I visited, on the back of our proposal is just a simple graphic here that shows what the system currently looks like and what we're proposing. This parent empowerment, we bet the farm on that, and we actually found out that it does work. If you give people good information, you give them some assistance, they tend to behave in a way that acts in the best interest of their child. Again, inform parents and rewarding providers for doing the right things are the functions of a market that tend to work really well. We think by doing this, you also, and we found out, you can minimize a lot of the bureaucracy and you can maximize your opportunity for those high return children. As I said earlier, the accountability is here. This is not a highly regulated model. This is more of a market model that, as I said, we've tested and we know that works, and it will prepare kids for school. We have found almost no mobility in these populations, and very mobile populations if parents are engaged. We think that the taxpayer also has some confidence, and we will get the return on investment that the Federal Reserve says we will. And that confidence will be important. We have the highest percent of women in the workforce of any state in the country. We have, in large part, a workforce development system. We don't intend to change that, but we do think that if these children are going to be in some kind of care outside of the home, that we ought to maximize our opportunity to do the very best job we can. We think that what we have demonstrated with the private money indicates that this would be a reasonable way to go. There will be more children enrolled in high-quality programs.
Actually, I want to just, if I can jump in, sure. Dwayne. We didn't bring full evaluation. Some of you have sat through numerous evaluation presentations of our material, and we're happy to come back if you're ever interested in that, but I wanted to just hit a couple of the highlights here. A lot of this information, in fact, all of it is available on our website at www.melf.us. But here are some of the key things that we've learned from our evaluation so far. Through the Parent Aware pilot and the work in the scholarship program and our other pilots, there are more kids enrolled in high-quality programs. So right now, we have over 500 scholarship kids in St. Paul. We've got over 339 programs that are rated through this rating system. Every one of those programs has better quality today than when they entered the system, because a big part of the process is supporting their quality improvement. And those programs serve over 22,000 kids just in our pilot area. So I think that that's a huge issue, more kids in more high-quality spaces. Another thing that we've learned is that parents are more involved in their children's education. As Dwayne said, in our St. Paul pilot, one of the things that's been most challenging is that we predicted that there would be a lot of turnover. This is a very stressed, highly mobile population. And from month to month, we watch these numbers because they have cost implications for us. And we've had no turnover. In fact, from the last report to this report, we actually added one child who had sort of gone below the radar and come back. So that we're really getting parents plugged in, that this is a really important asset for their kids, and they're working hard to keep their kids there. And then finally, kids are progressing towards school readiness. For a long time, there's been a lot of research that shows high-quality programs have a huge impact on school readiness, particularly for poor kids. And we're seeing that in our own pilot. So when we looked even at child outcomes in the Parent Aware rated programs, we saw that our kids in those programs, the majority of them are either at or above national averages on measures of language, literacy, and pre-numeracy. This is a big deal, particularly because it's more true. We have kids who are low-income kids showing more than expected progress. We couldn't have asked for a better outcome than that. So I just wanted to give you a highlight there, and we can come back to any of this if folks want to, but some of our key lessons.
I think that we can stand for any questions.
Well, thank you very much. First on the list is Representative Ward.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Benson, Ms. Davis, thank you. I had the pleasure of, for the last 4 years, serving on the education early childhood committee that we had in the house here for the last 4 years, and have heard your presentation a number of times, and I was impressed not only with the return on the investment, but just what you're doing for getting our kids prepared to have more success in their future education. I think even Governor Dayton has suggested that early childhood investment is very, very critical in our state and in our children. I wanted to ask, though, that, you know, I know that you had the Blue Earth. You had three pilot areas, the Blue Earth, the St. Paul, and Minneapolis. And were there any differences in the results between Blue Earth? I come from a real Minnesota district, greater Minnesota district, what do we call real Minnesota, versus the St. Paul, Minneapolis area. Were there any differences in the results that you secured from real Minnesota versus the metro area?
Benson, Ms. Davis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, it's a great question, and the answer is yes. In real Minnesota, we saw that, particularly in the Parent Aware pilot, we had challenges getting programs to volunteer to be rated. I think that our team worked, and it wasn't me, so I can give them a lot of credit. They worked really hard to make that happen. We understand that there are differences in supply, you know, the more licensed family child care programs, particularly in greater Minnesota. And so, well, we had actually really great luck getting licensed family programs in the metro area to step up and be rated, not as much so in rural, in Blue Earth and Nicollet. So I think that we learned a lot, and I think that the implementation team has been working hard to try to figure out how we would do it differently if this rolled out statewide. Our proposals, when they're introduced, will take that into account. There's a lot in those recommendations that's focused on quality improvement. We hear all the time, we just don't have the resources for quality improvement that they have. You know, the Greater Twin Cities United Way and other organizations have stepped up. So I hear your point, and I think that we need to take those lessons from the pilot into account to roll this out statewide.
And Mr. Chair, just one follow-up, please. And how did you go about selecting Blue Earth over the other? Representative Briner, I'm trying to dodge here with you. how did you go about selecting Blue Earth rather than, you know, another area in the state?
Davis.
If you look at our board list, which is back up on this screen, Gene Taylor from Taylor Corp has been extremely active in early childhood down in that area. So, quite frankly, that's why.
Okay.
And just so I could add just one thing, that we actually had four pilots, Minneapolis, St. Paul, but we also had a suburb, Wayzata, and Blue Earth and Nicollet. So we had four.
Representative Plum.
How uniform was the 50% unprepared across the state?
Ms. Davis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Plum, that is from not from a study that we conducted. That's from the Minnesota Department of Education. I don't know if there's anyone here from MDE. But my understanding is that those numbers are pretty constant across the state. I can get you more information about that from MDE.
Representative Bob.
Then I'd like to understand how... Mr. Chair, I'd like to understand how there's such disparity in results through school. If it's uniform that there's 50% unprepared, we need to find out what districts are doing successfully to overcome this, whether it's in kindergarten or throughout the career of the students. And so I don't know if it's our staff and research people that could find out you know, what's successful, because apparently if this is a uniform issue across the state and we have successful districts to overcome this, we need to learn from that so we can try and cross-pollinate that technique.
Ms. Davis, Mr. Benson, any comment on that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's a great observation. The challenge, obviously, is there will be pockets in some areas. Our largest pilot in St. Paul here, for example, 38% of the mothers did not graduate from high school. 50% of the children, English is not spoken in the home. Over 60% had never seen a computer. So it's obviously a challenged population. And by defining that population, and they're in other parts of the state, many of you represent, I suspect, Worthington or wherever, but what we found is if you give those parents good information and you help them along, they behave most like most all parents. So our focus is pre-zero, really third grade on, to entering school, preschool. Beyond that, you raise some good points, but to the extent we can define that population, that was our findings.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kwan, one more thing I would add is that, so if your point is that 50% aren't ready when they get to the kindergarten door, and that, and obviously some of them are catching up, the return on investment that our Rolnick talks about is based on avoiding those costs that the districts incur to get those kids who aren't ready when they start up to speed. Special ed costs, other kind of intervention costs, which are extraordinarily expensive and can be avoided if those children have high quality early childhood experiences.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some of the successful districts are spending half of what the high-end districts are spending, and so it might be approach as opposed to approach and technique. I'm just looking at, I want to do something for early, but I want to start cross-pollinating the techniques and approaches that are working for students to other districts so all students can successfully incorporate and the students in the classroom now can be improved in their results as opposed to rolling something in. Because if we just focus on pre, then we've got the ones that are in school now that aren't receiving that success. And that's what I'm after. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kwan. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Benson, I think I noticed that MNCAN yesterday was focusing on the quality ratings and the small print they had, the scholarships, but I got the feeling they were asking for things that didn't cost money this year just because perhaps of the budget situation. But I noticed Ms. Davis focused on we actually need to fund these things too. It doesn't really help a lot to give information if we don't have access, which of course for poor people comes with having funding. And I'm wondering, I saw you had a couple of tax credits there, which of course don't do a lot for poor people, but are you doing anything with funding for more access to go along with the quality ratings this year, or have you given up on that and are waiting for better funding years?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Benson.
And Representative Greiling, if you look at the HERO tax credit, it builds upon the $20 million that we have raised. There is a willingness out there to fund. We think with this added incentive that you can bring more money into this system, but it's all driven by parent aware, high quality, and you can bring more money into this system that we have demonstrated is willing to invest, and it would come from a public-private partnership.
Mr. Representative Greiling?
So, Mr. Benson, are you...
Just keep guessing, you'll get something.
I want to call him Senator Benson, so I guess that would work as well. But what are you going to do anything with the scholarships?
Mr. Benson. Or Ms. Davis.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this in this public-private partnership, the first thing that we require is the high quality. And then this public-private partnership would in large part go for scholarships that I could purchase, General Mills could purchase, Cargill, all the people that funded us maybe would buy 100 of them.
So,
Representative Greiling.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Benson, then, so you're talking about the tax credits to contribute to the scholarship fund.
Yes.
Wouldn't it be more efficient just to fund sliding fee child care?
Mr. Benson, Mr.
Chair, Representative Greiling, part of our proposal is about access. So while we're saying that we would do it this year in a cost-neutral way, but to better use the access money that we have, so link it to quality. Right now, there's no requirement that child care assistance money be used for, be linked in any way to quality, quite frankly. And so our proposals are to reform the current public spending system first, and then I think that you're right, that there the system is inadequately funded at every level. Parents can't afford it. Programs can't survive on the CCAP rates that the state's paying right now. And so the whole system is not aligned correctly. So what we're saying is reform it and build accountability into it, link the money to the quality and accountability, and then that makes the case for making more investment in the future.
And Ms. Davis, this is outside the purview of this committee, but can you just very briefly, like in less than a minute, describe the child care assistance program, just so a lot of new members in this committee, they may not be familiar with what it is.
Mr. Chair, yeah, I'll do my best.
Yeah.
It is a system that I think, as Duane was saying, was originated, and it still serves really to be a work support for parents who are on welfare, who are in MFIP. So if you are engaged in work activities or other allowable activities, which include a limited amount of education or things like that, then as part of your benefits, you also get child care assistance. The child care assistance program in this state does not pay market rate to most providers. I think there are providers who could attest to that. So that's what I'm saying about the system being under.
Representative Greiling, did you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, I support the quality ratings, and I think that's a really good thing, and I'm so very grateful that MELF is pushing that with a bipartisan board and coalition, and I think that's so important because there has been resistance to quality ratings here at the legislature. But I also just think, and I think it's really good to tie it to the funding, but I always, this is nothing new for me, as Mr. Benson would know, but I just think that to tie the quality ratings to the sliding fee child care, which is already geared to giving more to poor people, and if we want to reform how that's passed out, that's, I think, open to debate, and I would debate it could be reformed as well. But I just think this convoluted system of tax credits and then putting it into a public-private pot that's going to be $13,000 ahead for scholarships doesn't seem to me to be the way to maximize the participation numbers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greiling, we don't have a bill before the committee today, but I can say that our proposal will not be at the same level that we funded privately in the pilots. That was $13,000 a year for a full-time center-based placement, but that's not what we're proposing here. And I want to also be clear, the tax credits are to leverage more private investment into the system. We are also talking about reforming the system that's publicly funded.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might, and Representative Greiling, Erica Moss, with some work with the Federal Reserve and us, has found out that we have 35 funding streams in 4 agencies currently in order to prepare children for school. So we think that this, having it follow the people that we intend to serve, is much more efficient, much more directed, and I think we've been adequately been able to demonstrate that it works.
Mr. Chair, could I ask one more? Thank you for being so indulgent. I know in the campaign, candidate Emmer was talking about eliminating some other funding streams and then putting them together into, I think it was this program, but I could be wrong about that. But when you are looking for funding in a year when there isn't a lot, would you be, would any of that that you're proposing eliminate any other programs? You know, the obvious one that he was talking about was sliding fee child care. But even, you know, I get a lot of positive feedback in my districts for school readiness. Yes, it's not full-time for kids, but a lot of kids can participate in that for very little money. It's really cost-effective, and it makes a big difference. And even there, they have waiting lists, though. But I look at that price tag of, you know, $13,000 for one kid, and I think you could get a lot of kids running through school readiness for just one kid that can participate in a scholarship.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Greiling, we found actually when we did the St. Paul pilot that we had to braid, and some of you have heard that term, we had to braid the various funding streams, and then we could add to it. In our mind, by definition, that tells us that the system isn't directed ultimately to the customer. It's more supply-driven. So to the extent that we can get it more related to the person of people we intend to serve and their children, we think it's not only much more efficient, but it actually has better results because everybody behaves differently. We spent a fair amount of money promoting Parent Aware, and we did it through streaming, and we did it through public radio ads. We did it with a lot of different ways. And what we found was that the customers changed behavior, and they sought out quality. And as a result, the providers called us and said, how do we become 4-star? So those market forces we think that we could demonstrate they actually work well to improve quality. But the system, when you have to braid different funding streams in order to accomplish it, in my mind anyway, suggests maybe that it could be much more efficient.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and first just a huge compliment and word of thanks to the MELF team and you two in particular. When you think about much of what we talk about, the buzzwords of redesign and new models and how do we deliver for value and get results, I think this may be a model for how that takes place in the future when you look at the private sector investment, the fact that this was a really rigorous five-year pilot-driven study with real metrics and detailed data. Absolutely, it's the kind of foundation, I think, on which we can make good public policy decisions. And I'm really excited about this proposal. There's a couple provisions in here that I'm maybe not super excited about. But when you think about the transition from, you know, multiple bureaucratically managed funding streams and all of the overhead that's associated with that, when you think about targeting the absolutely most disadvantaged kids in our state with these scarce resources, I'm just really excited about the concept and think we should have a really robust discussion about this because it's probably a type and a model for how we approach problems going forward. So thanks for all your effort and for all the private support here. But I do have a question, and that is, and you've heard it from me before, but with regard to the quality rating system, when we implement this and tie state funding streams, regardless of whether it's running through Parents with Choice, if we tie the funding to only those centers or home-based units, whatever it's applicable to quality-rated institutions, aren't we kind of creating a two-tier system? And isn't there going to be a huge swath of the current pre-K network that's going to be excluded from this unless they kind of conform to the state model and the state definition of quality? How do we end up not having a two-tiered system and excluding a huge number of child care and pre-K providers from having the opportunity to participate?
Well, Mr. Chair is not here, but Representative Downey, I think that part of the answer is anybody can participate. It's a voluntary rating system, and anyone can step into it. And part of the way that we think it should be structured when it's statewide is that what that system would give programs that do volunteer to be rated is resources to help them improve their quality. So I think that to say that we're excluding them, I think that it would be a choice that programs would make. And I think that the other part of it is that, frankly, if we're talking about public resources that are increasingly scarce, I think at some point we may need to exclude providers who don't sort of step into that quality pathway.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And then a second question. I know I've argued this a little bit, too, in terms of where we locate the quality rating system, and it sounds like you're still recommending that we would locate the quality rating system mechanism and administration and things in state government. Did you explore maybe making that entire thing a private entity, an underwriter's laboratory or a consumer's report type thing? And if there's value for the consumers, the parents, and there's value for the providers to have this information exchange in the market, why wouldn't they be willing as kind of participants in the market and another private entity be willing to participate in all of that as compared to, once again, kind of institutionalizing it within the state?
Dave? Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, I think that you raise a great point, and I will say that our board has discussed that, and it's likely that that will be part of our proposal to have part of this be privatized. Clearly, the promotion board would provide some of that function using a solely, you know, private funding and completely a private organization. I want to be clear that, not to get too deep into the weeds on the Child Care Development Fund, but some of the federal money that comes to the state for child care must, by federal demand, be set aside for quality improvement. And that has been a tremendous resource to this pilot throughout since 2007, since we started. The Department of Human Services has been a great partner in aligning those quality improvement resources with Parent Aware. So we're all sort of moving using the same framework. And it's been hugely helpful. So I think that one of the things we need to keep in mind is that we need to keep that quality improvement support that is public and is sort of earmarked by the feds that way sort of moving along in this track too. So I think that there could be a division of responsibility that might make some sense.
Mr. Dunning? Okay. Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just an initial comment on the whole criticism of the system. I'm a little reluctant to lump all the efforts that you put into one category under the label the system, simply because I think one of our failings has been to early childhood and daycare, first of all, are two distinct areas of enterprise in our culture. They have been for the last many decades. It's only recently that they've been coming together. So they've had supports from different directions with different goals, and I think we've only begun to, in the last decade, through our recognition of brain research, to understand the need to bring those two together. So a lot of pieces of the system have been very separate strands, and I think it's just unfair to criticize them uniformly for not achieving goals that they were never designed or intended to achieve. So that's just a little footnote on this whole discussion. I find your chart that has all the no's in relation to this current system and all the yeses in relation to yours a little bit self-serving and not very sophisticated in terms of original intent and so forth. But that's a whole, I don't want to go there totally, but and you can comment on that, Amen. I am very supportive of the work you're doing. I represent the Mankato area. I've been very aware of the pilot project. Mankato has not only was Gene Taylor one of the reasons for the pilot being down there, but because of the kinds of partnerships that exist in our community through the university, our school district, and our early childhood efforts, both public and private, ECFE and Head Start, and all of those organizations are at the table in our community with a common partnership for improving early learning. So I really respect the work that's been done. I just hope we can not see it as pitting one vision against another, but figuring out how to use the research that you've done to bring all of these visions on board with a common direction.
David, Mr. Benson, any comments?
Mr. Chair, if that may, just one response. I think you're exactly right about the separation historically between child care and early childhood or early learning. And I think that conceptually it's a shift that our board made. I mean, I think when we started, we thought of those as two separate systems. Clearly the state thinks of them as two different systems. And I think that that doesn't serve kids. We shouldn't be surprised. And I'm sorry for, I don't mean in any way to indict the work that providers are doing. They're working really hard, and they've been doing it largely with no support and no real direction about how to improve the quality. And I think that's one of the things that Parent Aware has provided. And I think that it's a very it's a great point, and we need to move towards school readiness throughout the system.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Briner. The intention was not to indict anyone. The intention was that the people that deliver this are pretty nimble. They're pretty adaptive to change, and we found that. And I think they liked working in the different system as well. But I think you capture kind of what I think our board and we realize is there hasn't been a common vision of why we do this. We bifurcated here and there and everything, and then we wonder why it's bifurcated here and there and everything. So what we've tried to do is have our singular focus on school readiness, and we're finding that the market can change. Thank you for your confidence.
Representative Briner, any follow-up? Okay. I think we'll allow for one more question so that we can move on to the School Board Association. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Downey, for your two questions. He's not paying attention now, but Representative Downey, thank you for raising the two questions you did, because rural Minnesota, and maybe throughout the state, our child care providers are anxious about a two-tier system. And with that said, I want Ms. Davis to name, because we have at least a half a dozen new members on this committee, will you name or list the criteria for Parent Aware for the quality rating system so they hear what this is and probably why I'm applauding Representative Downey for raising that issue about the two-tier system, and are we going to be dividing now those who are providing not only child care but early education?
Davis.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, what the criteria are for quality in Parent Aware? Okay, so what we did when we started this pilot was looked at the evidence about which factors, which elements of a program are most correlated to getting kids ready for school, knowing there are other things that parents value that they'll make decisions on that are important, and not to dismiss the importance of any of those. But the things that we rate on are family partnerships, teacher training and education, tracking learning, and hang on, I want to get the words right. Well, family partnerships, teacher training and education, tracking learning, and not poverty. Thank you. I think that we have a different name for it, but it's whether or not the programs are using a curriculum that has evidence to show that it's going to lead to school readiness outcomes. I want to be clear that we're also not setting up early childhood programs so that they look like little classrooms and babysit and desks. That's not what we're talking about, but using developmentally appropriate practice, appropriate learning environments, whether you're tracking children's progress towards school readiness and using that information to interact with kids during the day. And so again, those are the standards that we've used during the pilot, trying to keep the set as the burden as low as possible in terms of providers having to, you know, give lots of documentation, but things that we really think matter to improving school readiness.
Representative?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We'd like to thank you for your time, Mr. Benson, Ms. Davis. Appreciate your testimony today.
Thank you.
I would have the School Board Association. Good afternoon, Ms. Kelleher.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be here today. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. My goal today is to take up about 5 minutes of your time and share with you a little bit about the people I represent and the organization I work for, so you get a better picture of how we interact in the session going forward. And I did bring some visual aids, not nearly as good as the live puppy folks, but I'll be trying to do my best to fill in. I have got with me Kirk Schneiderwin, who is my associate director. You'll see us here virtually in every meeting, following those as you move forward. We represent elected people around the state who serve on their school boards. We have no employees as part of our organization, and our legislation and our legislative initiatives, the times that you'll hear us up here, we'll be talking from our legislative positions, and there's something called the pink sheets. There's about 18 to 19 pages. They range on issues not only here in education, in taxes, in civil law, so we get around the legislature a lot. Today we're sharing with you sort of what our 2001 legislative platform is. On there we talk about, and I really want to talk about, funding that invests in this committee, making public education the top funding priority for the state. We'd like that to be clearly done. What our board took and our delegate assembly endorsed the idea that in the first 30 days within session, that we think it would be very beneficial if we knew what that education budget total was going to look like. Boards have to start letting their staff know February 1st about what next year's school year is going to look like. And when we're getting done in session in May and in April, it's very difficult to manage that going forward. Our second point there has to do with third-party billing. This is an interaction with the Department of Health, and the reason we share this is special education students oftentimes receive health services at school. They, through a long, tedious process, get to bill Medicaid for that, and we want to loosen that up and make it easier. The Department of Health has been difficult for school districts around the state to work with. We'd like to make that clear and that process better. We want to repeal the school aid delay. There is a short-term school, a month-to-month cash flow piece. It's 127A. That month-to-month allows the state to borrow money to increase their cash flow. They have to pay it back to schools within the year they borrow it. as well as the SHIP, which is an accounting SHIP, where they actually push money forward so they get a state receives a one-time savings. And last but not least, my association, for the first time since we were an association, we became one in 1920. We are the eighth oldest association in the nation. Decided to ask for some discretionary levy authority when it comes to renewing an expiring operating referendum. And I'd just like to share that I think the reason they looked at that is they are struggling financially at the local level. Cuts there, as you all know, have faces attached to them. And board members at this point are feeling pushed to the wall to provide the kind of quality programs they'd like to see for our kids. So my association in past years has always voted in favor of a voter-approved referendum, but this year said, please, for these issues, when we are looking at a financial crisis for the state of Minnesota, allow us the authority to renew expiring referendums. So with that, I'll share, but I want to show you my handouts I bought. This is our delegate assembly book. Kirk and I put this together in October of every year for our members to vote on and add to our legislative positions. It consists of about 30 pages of background, not only statute, but analysis of statute and how it works for our school board members. They do use a rather sophisticated process to get there. This is one of two big manuals you get when you're elected a school board member. This has to do with school district mandatory policies. And each board member, when elected, gets a copy of this and a copy of school law that's equally as big. So I just wanted to share with you the daunting task that your local officials have to face going forward. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll pause, and Kirk and I would be happy to answer some questions.
Thank you, Mrs. Keller. Any questions? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Schuneman, Ms. Keller, thank you for being here. And I'm only halfway through my sheet, but I've got three questions so far. The Simplify third-party billing consent at the state and federal level, can you tell me, Representative Will Morgan had a bill last year regarding that third-party billing to make that a much more smooth, streamlined operation for school districts to allow third-party billing. Is that the same piece of legislation that you would, and I don't know, I can't remember if you guys supported that last year or not. Is that the piece of legislation that you're talking about?
Mr. Scheidewein?
Mr. Chair and that representative. Yes, that as I understand it, that would be a similar piece. And so we're trying to streamline the process for districts between the Department of Education and the Department of Health that would allow us to tap into some Medicaid dollars for districts. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, and that's good for, I mean, that's just good for our kids, period, or good for our districts and our kids, period, and so I hope that that does move forward, and I would encourage you to, somebody to bring forward that piece from Representative Will Morgan last year, for sure. And then also, you know, the piece about renewing and expiring operating levy referendum, does your proposal have a reverse referendum with it?
Mr. Scheidewein or Ms. Keller?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Ward, there was not a piece for revocation. We did share that having the ability to locally levy, at least for cities and counties, comes with caps, comes with the ability to revoke that authority by the local taxpayer. So when we asked our delegate assembly to consider that, that was in the background we shared with board members, and they still approved this point going forward. So my answer is, Representative Ward, yes, they knew that revocation would probably be a part of a discretionary levy. I don't think they're going to dance and say they love it, but they certainly understand that would be part of the new authority.
That worked.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the third question, I guess, and so there is your proposal, your piece of legislation does not have a piece for a reverse referendum on it, that, if I understand that correctly. Is that correct?
Yeah. Governor.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ward, this is not something we've put into language.
Okay. Thank you very much. My last question until I get through the other half of my sheet, Mr. Chair, is can you cite any research that shows that the starting date for a post-Labor Day starting date is better for kids than a pre-Labor Day start for kids? Could you cite that research, please?
Mr. Scheidewein?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I'm surprised you raised this question. I think we will have research. I think that I think the commissioner, in her wisdom, understood that school districts were willing to share resources. I think school districts in the Southwest are looking at new achievement models, new student learning models that will allow greater flexibility for school districts. And so I think part of that requirement is to make sure that the assessments are reviewed on an annual basis, and I believe there's a three-year window for that. So I think the research will be there. I think it's I understand for school districts, this is a local issue. This is a local control issue for many school districts and want to meet the needs of their community. And so it's may not be specifically tied to student achievement, but it meets the needs of the community as much as they're trying to improve student achievement as well.
And follow up, please, Mr. Chair. Sure. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Schwinneman, for that. And to date, though, there isn't any, and I understand the Southwest school districts that are doing that right now based on the past commissioner's approval of that last session, but that there's no data from that currently that shows any results yet. Is that correct?
Mr. Shadwin.
Mr. Chair, to my knowledge, no. I mean, I think it needs to be determined yet.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on Representative Ward's earlier questions, I don't want to touch the school start one today, but do you have any figures, you know, looking at maybe a 1 or 2 year window on this referendum thing? How many referendums are expiring this year and next year? What number are we talking about here of the 336 Minnesota school districts?
Mr. Chadwin?
I don't have a good figure. Maybe the research staff would, but I think the issue is we're talking about renewals, and I think that's an important distinction that we're not just going out. I think it's about a renewal for the same dollar amount for the same period of time. And what we, based on, I believe it was last year's data, I think there were 17 districts that were clean, clear, same amount, went out for $500, renewing for $500 for 10 years. And I believe the record was a 17 for 17 renewal process, but nonetheless they went to the voters. And so the evidence shows on renewals for the same amount, same number of years, at least for last year. I realize that's a small sampling, but for last year indicate that the renewals generally pass for school boards and school districts. Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Anderson.
Mr. Chairman,
Ms. Keller.
Can I just follow up on that a little
Certainly.
Bit? Pre-1972, referendums in the state of Minnesota for operating expenditures were unlimited. They went on forever. And once we hit 92, the legislature decided that these would only be available for a 10-year window and converted everybody into that 10-year window. Now, there was no real magic about the 10 years. They just thought it was the right number of years. So that as we look at this issue, we really encourage you to think about, is 10 years the right number? Should you be able to renew a levy that's out there, you know, one time or multiple times going forward? And we're just ready to have that conversation with you. But certainly the historical piece of this wasn't made based on data or based on research, but just a legislative change that came forward since 92.
Thank you. Representative Dieter?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I have a question. I know that Minnesota School Board Association has been one of the organizations who has spent some time educating themselves and becoming familiar with the issue of school trust lands. And so what was my understanding that the MSBA organization had brought forth some sort of a platform statement or recommendation up through the ranks and been voted on? But I don't see anything here on school trust lands. Could you tell me a little bit about what that looked like and sounded like so I understand where it fits into your platform, if it does?
Ms. Kelleher.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Dietrich, it is an honor to work on the school trust fund lands. It's a passion the school boards have been doing and I personally have taken on for the last 6 years. And it's really an untold story of where I think schools actually have good funding news coming forward. our association has taken multiple steps forward supporting school trust fund lands and really efficiencies of the management of the trust fund lands throughout the years. This last year, after the news came in that the forestry part of the school trust fund land, so that 2.5 million acres of forest is managed for the school children of Minnesota. Off of those, the $10 million they generated in gross net revenue, they were able to only put $100,000 into the school trust funds. And at that point, my association and my school board members really felt it was time to step up to the plate and say there's got to be a better way to manage these than the present way. And we supported a change out of the DNR, basically have an executive director being able to put an RFP out for services to manage these lands and resources for the school children of Minnesota. And we feel passionately as an organization, once again, that in 10 years, it looks like if things keep progressing and the economy grows, that trust fund lands can produce another $1 billion for school districts in our trust fund, along with a federal trade at the VWCA level. And I'd be happy to talk longer about that, Mr. Chairman. But those are two revenue sources that would generate new money that we wouldn't have to cut anybody for school kids around the state. And it's really, if there's good news in this session, it's a real good news story. So we appreciate your leadership. And it deserves to be part of this. But to be honest, Representative Dietrich, it has its own 4 or 5 page synopsis, standalone, and not just, it's not something we put into a line.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you. I wanted to know where it was.
Representative Van Zyl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would argue that since 2003, we have had a significant and major decline in state support for the 336 districts. And I would argue that there has been a corresponding increase in levies, which disproportionately impact property taxpayers in property poor districts. That as my premise requires me to ask the question, making public education the top funding priority for the state is a laudable, great objective by MSBA, but I find it so inconsistent with then asking us to provide boards with an open-ended authority to renew existing levies. Seems to me that those two goals work at cross purposes. We continue the trend of providing school kids in Minnesota with a less than uniform public education, which is in direct conflict with the state's constitution, which I'm going to talk about every chance I get from now until adjournment. Could you respond?
Ms. Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Anzell, you are very eloquent, and I love it when you talk passionately about school children, and it's something we all care about, and it's been challenging. If you look at it, property tax and equalization for school districts, I like to think is similar to LGA. It's sort of based on the effort it takes to spend $1, and that's a growing difference between the 5th and 95th percentile in school districts, and I think it's a challenge. It's a challenge that's in front of us all to do a better job on funding. And we have positions on equity and we that support equity, and it's something we strive to do, and I think it's a meticulous effort if you look for it every place, and I know how hard you work to accomplish that. We hope to assist you this year.
Anything else? Okay. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To kind of follow up on
the previous question, I represent and work in a district that receives, and the committee has heard this before, and again, I'm going to pound away at this. We receive about $8,400 per year per student in state funding. Other districts in the state receive as much as $14,400. I'm very interested in a solution to this inequity in funding, what I refer to as the funding gap. Your response, please. Kind of the same question.
Ms. Kelleher.
I understand that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, it's a point that we hear from our districts, too, and it's a challenge. In fact, we've got five superintendents sitting in the room that have been talking to members all day about their concerns going forward running small districts up north. And as times become harder, you've really got to face the challenges in front of you, and small rural districts and large metro districts are facing great challenges, and the charge we hope to assist you with is finding how to make that equitable about the state of Minnesota. I feel that's our constitutional charge. I wish I knew the magic combination to fix it, but MSBA is willing to partner with you and help get that done so all kids in Minnesota get an equal and equitable education.
Okay. Representative Breinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just maybe in anticipation of Thursday's hearing, I'd like to go down to the Improving Student Achievement section and ask for a little bit of a definition of proven under support proven alternative licensure methods.
Mr. Shedwin?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Breinert, and I think the issue is that the alternate licensure piece has been a discussion point for last year and this year as well. And I think that in general, I think that we like to see evidence that alternate licensure approaches have some evidence of working for students. And so I think it's as simple as that. I think our membership supported an alternative licensure approach last year, and I think they meant to have it vague, but also have some quality behind it as well. So,
Representative Brenner?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll take that for now, but I would suspect it might have some more delineation in terms of the different options that will be on the table for specific legislation.
We look forward to that. Representative Dietrich. Okay. And Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Van Zylk. I really appreciate your ongoing references back to our Constitution, and your friend Representative Rukavina described himself today as a progressive libertarian, so we may have lots of common ground here, the libertarian and constitutionalist among us. Actually, I think you raised an incredibly important point, and I don't think this is the appropriate legislative session maybe to grapple with this, but if you go back to the Constitution, and I do this periodically, it says the stability of a Republican form of government depending mainly upon the intelligence of the people, it shall be the duty of the legislature to establish a general and uniform system of public schools. And I really think if you think about the kind of civic intelligence that I think they were talking about, maybe more of a liberal arts education in order to inherit this Republican form of government and perpetuate it. I think we're asking a lot more of our schools these days in terms of we're asking them to make people career ready and college ready, and we're asking them to provide, in many cases, human services delivery functions. The mission of our schools and what we're asking teachers to do, I think, has grown far beyond what was originally intended here, and maybe there's case law and statute and other constitutional amendments that have expanded that. But then if you read on, too, it says the legislature shall make such provisions by taxation or otherwise, as with the income arising from the school fund, will secure a thorough and efficient system of public schools in each township in the state. And so I think when we refer back to the Constitution, we need to be a little careful because we, I think, clearly have slipped way beyond the original scope of public education. And we talk about provisions by taxation or otherwise. Very rarely do we talk about the otherwise only about the taxation. We talk about adequate funding, but we don't talk about an efficient system of public schools. And so I think if we look at the totality of what's in the Constitution around our mission and our commitment to public education, there's a lot of questions that get raised there. So I welcome you raising them, and maybe we can have an even broader discussion. We got a lot of budgetary matters to deal with, but a broader discussion of that topic I think would be a healthy one for this legislature and subsequent ones.
Representative Woodard.
Well, that's very difficult to follow up, Mr. Chair, but I have a more specific question for you. And that has to do with the repeal of the maintenance of effort requirement for school support personnel. And if we were to do that, can you kind of predict what would happen to our school districts, what would happen to those school support personnel? Would those roles continue to be played, or what's your prediction on that? Ms. Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Woodward. I can sum it up in one thing. We hire more counselors if you repeal the maintenance of effort. This law and this maintenance of effort, either to a certain number of counselors or budget and guidance counseling, has restricted how districts spend money. For example, we just got the education jobs money from the feds. Normally that money would have been given to counselors, and as I talked to Sue, certainly that's an area they would have liked to do. Unfortunately, it was one-time federal money, and with this maintenance of effort requirement, we didn't add them. So Minnesota hired no counselors with that money, and it's one of those things that are really not only hurting the profession but hurting the kids, and it needs to be removed. I think your local SUPs have a really good sense of what they need to do to help kids get through school. We need to get rid of some of this needless bureaucracy to help kids move forward.
Any other questions, members? That, we certainly appreciate your time, Ms. Keller, Mr. Scheidewind.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And our next meeting will be tomorrow, Wednesday, January 26. With that, this meeting is adjourned.